2:40. NPR and the BBC are staffing the Olympics and will do extensive reporting on sports and other news from Beijing. As part of that coverage, you will hear competition results in newscasts and on other programs, including AM 580 Sports Report. Sometimes these results will air before you have a chance to see taped events on television. This may on occasion be frustrating to those of you who were planning to learn the results through tape delay broadcasts. While we can sympathize, we see the Olympics as a news event, and our goal is to report news as it happens. To withhold results or provide so-called spoiler alerts each time we report on a new gold medal winner wouldn't be practical, especially in this time of instant communication and the 24-hour news cycle. So we hope you'll understand and forgive us if from time to time we do end up, in effect, spoiling it for you. And I do have a score to report coming up in this sportscast. The agent for Green Bay Packers quarterback Brett Favre says the three-time NFL Most Valuable Player could be traded to Tampa Bay or the New York Jets as early as today. Packers general manager Ted Thompson was not seen at practice this morning, and his scheduled early afternoon media availability was postponed. Two signs a trade involving Favre might be brewing. Buccaneers coach John Gruden refused today to address speculation that the team was on the verge of a deal for Favre, while Packers coach Mike McCarthy said he was happy the rest of his players were getting a chance to move on. The U.S. women's soccer team has dropped its Olympic opener, allowing two goals in the first 4 minutes of a 2-0 loss to Norway. The Norwegians outmuscled and out-hustled the Americans for their two goals while stifling the U.S. attack. The NL Central leading Chicago Cubs are looking for their 9th win in 11 games today. The Cubs are playing the Houston Astros in the finale of their series at Wrigley Field. In the bottom of the third, the Cubs lead 9-4. The St. Louis Cardinals are hoping for another win tonight over the Los Angeles Dodgers as they try to gain ground in the National League wild card race. And the Chicago White Sox and the Detroit Tigers continue their 3-game series at U.S. Cellular Field tonight. Chicago is a major league best, 24-7 at home since May 25th, while Detroit has dropped its last 5 games, all on the road. That's sports.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designer of the Busey Bank Main Branch renovation, on the web at ratioarchitects.com.
It's 2:43. The Justice Department says it's cracked an international identity ring that could make you at least think about cutting up your credit card when you hear the details. This is an identity theft ring. To start, the U.S. officials say hackers stole more than 40 million credit and debit card numbers from major U.S. retailers, among them Barnes & Noble, TJX, which is the owner of TJ Maxx, and Marshall's clothing stores. Kurt Nickisch reports from member station WBUR Boston.
A grand jury here indicted 11 people around the globe. Attorney General Michael Mukasey says it's impossible to put a dollar figure on the damage.
Computer networks and the internet are obviously an indispensable part of the world economy. They also provide extraordinary opportunities for criminals.
Boston's U.S. Attorney Michael Sullivan says the hackers started all their sophisticated work with a very low-tech security breach.
Simply driving around in a car with a laptop computer looking for accessible wireless computer networks.
Sullivan says once they found stores with unsecured systems, the hackers coded their way right in. TJX discovered its breach in 2006 after millions of credit card numbers were stolen. The company now says the broad reach of this international ring shows it's an industry-wide problem. Online security expert Richie Jennings agrees.
So it's entirely possible that a number of these companies weren't even aware that they had a data breach at all. They're just finding out right now.
And if they didn't know how important it is to secure personal data, they'll be hearing it soon from their customers. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Boston.
During this economic downturn, those in the business of reselling used goods are doing better than ever. More people are bringing in their old stuff to sell, hoping to turn it into some extra cash. NPR's Tovia Smith reports.
Ed Pomfret never used to worry so much about money. As a sales manager in the mortgage industry, he was making in the six figures. But that was before the mortgage crisis slashed his earnings by two-thirds, before he had to support a parent in assisted living, and before grocery prices went through the roof and gas hit $4 a gallon.
I've depleted every 401k I have had, and it's been, you know, a real bad couple of years.
Now, Pomfret is one of many people looking for new ways to make some cash.
So this is what I'm bringing in today. It's a Bobby Orr doll. Yeah, I got this when I was about 6 years old. It was from my mom and dad. It was a Christmas present.
Signed to you?
Yep, signed to me from Bobby Orr. So I'm going to give that up.
Pomfret plunks the doll down on the counter of a local eBay drop-off store. It's the modern version of the old pawn shop. They take your stuff, auction it on eBay, and give you back a cut of the proceeds, usually about half.
You know, we could get anywhere from $75 to $125, maybe more. You know how it is.
Pomfret smiles at store manager Rich Bobian and hands over the rest of his Bobby Orr collection.
This is the famous Stanley Cup shot, huh?
Yeah, the 1972 okay. Bobby Orr to Sanderson. Oh, he scored!
Wow.
It was once one of his most prized possessions, but now Pomfret says it has to go.
It meant everything, actually. It means everything to me now, too. It's just the cash is just a lot more valuable to me than having Bobby Orr in my basement collecting dust. You know, my little five-year-old girl not maybe going to get an ice cream because we have no money, that's going to hurt. But Bobby Orr's album, I'm moving it out of here.
We'll take these.
All right, great.
You know how the routine, right? It's taken us a couple of weeks.
A couple of weeks?
Yeah.
In this particular store in Sudbury, Massachusetts, volume has doubled from the same time last year.
The stuff is coming in faster than we can list it, and the busy time starts actually after Labor Day.
Bobian says he sees everything from businesses who've gone under and want to sell their computer and phone systems and entire inventories to families who've lost their homes and want him to sell everything they had, including, literally, the kitchen sink.
The euphemism, I think, is we're downsizing. We're seeing a lot of that.
Bobian says he's noticed people digging deeper than they used to and coming in with more valuable family heirlooms, china, crystal, collectibles.
They're taking things that they were hoping to hold on to and pass on, things that they didn't expect to have to sell. You could hear it in the voice. It just has to go. You know what I mean? You just hear that, and that they need that cash.
And you just put your shoes in there and put a name tag on it and on the floor under the rack.
Clothing consignment shops are seeing a similar boon.
These are the slides that I was going to wear to a wedding.
Wow, look at those. Striped, blue, green, yellow, pink.
Yeah, they're fabulous. You know, wonderful summer party shoes. But they didn't work.
At the Closet Exchange, a few towns away in Needham, Jean Blackweedy is dropping off a bag of the closet clutter she's hoping to convert to cash.
You know, the old days, I'd say, oh, I'll fit into it. Oh, I'll probably wear it. I'd hang on to it. But, yeah, it's going. I could have, you know, groceries or a tank of gas.
Shop owners say they, too, see people bringing in pricier things these days, like fine jewelry and high-ticket designer bags. But as people dig deeper...
Yeah. This one actually has some spots on it, so we won't be able to do that one.
Okay.
Owner Maggie Stark says sometimes it means they're digging too deep.
You hit the back of the closet or you hit grandma's closet, and it's a lot older than 2 years with massive shoulder pads, a lot of polyester. Yeah, that's got to go.
The really good news for consignment shops is that at the same time their supply is increasing, so is demand for used clothes at bargain prices. Many women who bring in clothes to sell don't even bother taking a cash payout. Instead, they take a store credit. So after they drop, they can also shop.
Thank you.
Tovia Smith, NPR News.
Springfield, Illinois' race riot of August 1908 lasted for 3 days. Black-owned businesses were burned to the ground. Two black men were lynched, and several others died in the crossfire. It's a dark chapter in the capital city's history that some are trying not to forget. Illinois Public Radio's Jenna Dooley has more on their efforts.
Some went to the country with food and clothing in sacks on their backs. The riot was serious for 3 days, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
It's a Saturday morning and a group of tourists are taking a walking tour in downtown Springfield. Garrett Moffitt is known locally for giving tours of Abraham Lincoln's old haunts. This summer, he's giving visitors another view of Springfield, the site of a deadly race riot where two black men were lynched and a billow of smoke covered the city for 3 days in 1908.
Throughout the day, the mob continues to grow in size. And, of course, in the heat of the sun, the mood of that mob destabilizes and things of a powder keg are about ready to ignite.
Moffitt shares with his group a booklet of pictures and is well-versed in the history of the riot. He's open to questions as the group follows the so-called path of destruction. But there are some questions no one can answer. Why did a town split along a racial divide? And what is its legacy in the city of the Great Emancipator? Here's the account. Two black men are sent to the county jail. Joe James is accused of the murder of Clergy Ballard, a white man. The other prisoner, George Richardson, is accused of raping a white woman. A crowd forms outside of the jail intent on vigilante justice. In an effort to protect the prisoners from the ensuing mob, officers create a diversion.
And Sheriff Warner now calls in a false fire alarm to the firehouse. And as those fire trucks are fire brigades pulling away from the jail, the mob turns their attention to the leaving fire brigade. And at the very same time, Sheriff Warner slips his two prisoners out the back door of the jail into a waiting car owned by Harry Loper.
Moffitt's tour makes stops at the site of Harry Loper's restaurant on South Fifth, marking the first fatality of the riot, a white patron shot dead by a bullet flying out of the mob who is now onto the diversion ploy. The group makes another stop near the State Armory, the place where the mob is eventually met by the Illinois National Guard, called in by the governor of Illinois to quell the destruction. The tour ends at the site of Edwards School at the intersection of Spring and Edwards, where a wealthy black man, William Donegan, is dragged from his home and lynched. The chilling conclusion of Springfield's riot. Only one conviction of petty larceny came as a result of the riot, and the woman who made the accusation of rape, which started it, later confesses to fabricating the story. It's a solemn history which played out in the backdrop of Lincoln's Springfield. But it's also the event which sparked the formation of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or NAACP. Even so, it's a history often forgotten, either by ignorance or by shame.
The people that were white would put a white cross on their front door. Those were down what they call the Badlands. The white cross was a signal that there were no Negroes there and they'd be left alone.
Students in Springfield Southeast High School who have history teacher Tammy Douglas will spend a couple of days each school year discussing the riot's unanswerable questions. Douglas has been in the district for more than a decade and says she introduced the topic out of her personal experience with Springfield's forgotten history. Douglas says she didn't learn about the riot until she went to college at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.
I was born and raised in Springfield and had never heard about it, never been taught. So I was really shocked to learn that such a prominent organization that fights for equality resulted out of, you know, a horrible event that occurred in my hometown.
Douglas says in preparing for her class, she found that some of the research didn't match up with popular notions of race relations in Springfield.
Because of Lincoln, a lot of the rioters, that was their reason. Like, they blamed him. Because of you, we have African Americans in our town. So a quote that I saw in the research was, Abraham Lincoln brought him here and we'll run him out.
Douglas takes a day or two each school year to give a brief history and then spends the rest of the class dialoguing with students about the riot. She says the structure is laid back and the majority of students are hearing the story for the first time. That's why she says it's important to keep it alive.
I think the driving need is because it just simply wasn't discussed and it hasn't been taught. And you have to wonder when a society, a community, purposely ignores a major event that occurs. That, you know, to me, being a historian, that's, you know, something that I question. And I don't think anything should be kept secret like that. So I feel compelled to bring it to light.
Douglas says for the 100th year anniversary, she may spend more time teaching about the riot in all of her history classes.
I'm looking at this. Did this part here where it was talking about where she's speaking, Sarah Crawford? I think it's Sarah Crawford.
Springfield College Benedictine University is also bringing the story of the race riot to a modern audience. The college is sponsoring a production which includes a series of monologues portraying the people involved in the riot. The production is slated for the fall. Sandra Young is a Springfield resident who came out to audition for the show. As she skims the script, Young finds the part she wants to portray and acts it out before friends, family, and complete strangers. It's the lament of an African-American woman forced out of her home as the riot escalates by the man she cared for when he was a boy.
He was like two people. One so angry he could destroy my home, and another that showed curious courtesy that was gonna warn me beforehand. As I watched my house burn, I looked at him and I wondered which side was in control and which side was on fire.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
Tomorrow we'll hear from the University of Illinois at Springfield scholar who conducted interviews with residents who lived through the riot. And to hear complete coverage from the anniversary of the 1908 race riot, you can tune into Illinois Edition this Friday night at 10 and Saturday morning at 11 on AM 580 or 90.9 FM HD2, or listen online at will.illinois.edu.
Earth and Sky.
Honeybees are still leaving their hives and not returning, and scientists still aren't sure why.
But as of today, we don't have a single cause that we can point to. We're looking at some combination of factors.
That's Jeff Pettis of the USDA's Bee Research Lab in Maryland. He said adult worker bees began disappearing from commercial hives in the U.S. 2 years ago. Bees die when separated from their colonies. Pettis said what's going on is likely similar to how people can get one illness, but later, in a weakened condition, die of something else.
Some primary stressor on the colony could be pesticide exposure, it could be poor nutrition, it could be parasitic varroa mites feeding on the colonies, followed by some secondary pathogen that's actually doing the killing. That pathogen could be a virus.
Beekeepers lost 37% of their colonies in 2007. This phenomenon, which scientists call colony collapse disorder, is suspected in at least half those losses. Meanwhile, honeybees add $15 billion in value per year to U.S. agriculture by pollinating 130 crops, including almonds and apples.